Hello and welcome to Shape the System, where we find and tell the stories that help people to rethink the way the world works. We interview people from all over the world who are helping to change our systems for the better. Shape the System is an independent podcast with support from KPMG High Growth Ventures, who help ambitious founders and their teams scale up for success. More about KPMG High Growth Ventures after the interview. We hope you enjoy this episode.
G'day everyone, welcome back to the show. We're going to be talking about something today that I've actually been thinking a lot about and have a lot of questions about and have zero answers about. So I'm pumped to be talking to Grant Gunnison from Zero Homes about this topic. And I'm not even going to tell you what the topic is. I'm going to let Grant introduce the topic of conversation for today, which is probably a first in our 100 or so episodes. So Grant, welcome to the show. Tell me a little bit about what we're going to be talking about today, and also tell me a little bit about how you arrived to be working on this problem.
Cool. Thank you for having me on, Vincent. The topic of today is how do you solve the climate crisis in single family homes? Our purview is the United States, but of course this problem is pervasive across the world. So we can talk about some of those other things, but our focus is in the US here. Just to say, let me back up for a second, introduce myself as well. I'm based in Colorado. Zero is about 4 years old. I originally grew up in Southern California into a general contracting business. So got an emotional and physical face full of what it's like to, do some of the hard work in homes. And then I also have a technology background. So spent many years in electronic software, building space systems and the like. And my role today is actually trying to bring some technology into a space that, historically has had challenges innovating and helping people be more productive to then solve, the climate challenge in housing. So maybe that's a little bit of a background here, but a lot of things revolve around technology, a lot of social challenges in helping homeowners through problems and then ultimately trying to back into solving the climate problem.
Yeah, beautiful. Okay, so landing us right in the space, we're going to be talking a lot about the electrification of homes. And so I probably want to, before we get into some of the detail of what you guys are doing and how you're doing it and solving some of that both behaviorally and through technology, because there's some really interesting stuff in there. Let's just talk about that. And the US context is great. Everyone understands how big the US is, 350, 400 million people, whatever it is. So let's break that down to single family homes and the energy footprint of those homes collectively, individually. Let's understand the size of the problem and the opportunity, and then we'll start to move from there.
Yeah. So, I'll put it back in the climate context. And maybe before we just talk specifically about the climate lens, ultimately the problem we're solving for homeowners is not a climate problem, but in order to actually solve the climate problem, you do need to solve the homeowner's problem, right? So there's sort of two separate things, and we could talk about why that's the way that it is, but maybe the very short of it is that people are not really willing to pay just to solve a climate problem today. That might change in the future, but all to say, just to size up the size of the challenge, about one-fifth of all emissions today come from single-family homes in the U.S. That's really from their operational footprint. And then in terms of how many homes that comes from, it's about 80 million. There's about 60 or so million that operate on top of fossil fuels, and then another 20 million or so that are all just electrically driven, but they still have emissions, of course, because they're using electrons that are produced, not just by clean energy. So that's kind of the size of the challenge. And, that's a lot of homes, right? Yeah. I think when you understand what it takes to do one home or even one project in one home, you start to blow that up to, wow, I got to do six or seven projects in a home. 80 million of those. And you go, my God, this is mind boggling, right? And so, that is the level of ambition that we have as a business, is to go actually solve that grand challenge, if you will. And the way we do that is by helping, one Miss Susan Jones at a time, right? And so
it's very specific character persona.
Yeah, of course. You have to have personas you talk about in your company. So all just to say that, we're trying to create a standardized process for what today is a very bespoke, customer journey. And so that is a lot of, you know, what we're trying to do, systematize the experience, to be able to create, you know, sort of an automated yet extremely human experience for folks to actually go through the process.
Yeah. And I want to get into some of the experience a bit later on, but I want to drill into something you just said that I think bears calling out and reminding, that the vast, vast majority of people, I don't have a number, you might have a number in your experience, will not do this specifically because of the environmental outcome. And that's, I believe that to be true as well, but I think there is a general thread in climate circles or in the industry more broadly that kind of doesn't want to believe that. Is this what you encounter kind of day to day in the work that you're doing?
Yeah, we have probably four customer problems that we are trying to generally help people address. The first is my bills are high, and this is a wallet issue. I'm trying to reduce the cost of my home. The second is a comfort challenge, and I'm uncomfortable for one of many reasons potentially. There's a broken appliance problem. Oh no, I'm about to have a comfort problem, or I actively have a comfort problem, but it's not so much a latent, I'm just kind of uncomfortable. Everything seems to be working. And then the last thing, we'll just lovingly call this the climate warrior of, I have a carbon problem that I'm trying to address, right? The number of people that fall into the climate warrior column is extremely thin, you know, definitely less than 5%. I mean, this might be their second or third priority, but it is rarely their number one priority.
Interesting.
And so, you know, it is typically the other three issues that we're really solving, and we're trying to do that in a way that backs us into solving the climate problem.
Yeah. So either I have a bill that's high, I'm not comfortable, or something broke, they're my motivations to take action. And in some respect, it's if I can solve that and also paint the bucket in number four while I'm there, I'm happy and I'd prefer to do it that way. And so you're almost looking to get someone at a point of pain where they can make a better decision. Is that kind of where that sits?
That's right. And the good news for us is that the products that will help us solve the climate challenge also happen to be the highest performing products on the market. So that, you know, if that was not the case, this would be much harder than it actually is. The reality is we just need to educate folks on the value proposition of these new products. Often we're not even really telling the climate story in that. And people go, oh, wait, wow, I can have all these new amazing features in these products. Yeah, my cost, it has a different cost, certainly. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less, but there's perfect overlap in that. And so we don't, again, have to tell a climate story to every homeowner and go, oh, well, let's, you know, convince them to do good for the environment. It's really around how can we make your home the most comfortable and, you know, the highest performing. Often that is at the lowest operational cost.
And is that, I'm trying to understand what has led to this being true now. It probably wasn't true 20 years ago, is it? Certain electricity costs have come down, or the efficiency of these things have come down, the technology's got better. Like, what's driving that?
Yep, the technology certainly has gotten better. The boxes that we install definitely are higher performing than they used to be. I would say, generally speaking, electricity has been pretty inexpensive in the US. You know, that might be changing now with data centers and so on and so forth. But I would say it's not so much a fuel cost component that's making that true, but it's really the boxes themselves that are just higher performing.
Right. So, and so you're
getting better performance at lower cost. Generally.
Right. Just the scale issue. There's more people building heat pumps and building more of them. And so it's just an economy of scale around a manufacturing that has made it. So you can get a better heat pump for less money than you could 20 years ago.
Well, that's part of it, but there's actually been some real innovation in the actual architecture of the boxes at the same time. So there's a little bit of both, for sure. And, you know, there's even more performance to be had in designing better and better heat pumps. So I think we'll continue to see performance increase from the box itself. And, you know, and then there's design at the home that can provide some optimization in addition to maybe utility prices as well.
So yeah.
A few different numbers that are driving this.
Like, I think about this in the context of, say, cars, where a car burning petrol, at some point its performance is tapping out because you're doing a fundamentally the same chemical reaction, which is setting fire to petrol. But in batteries, for example, the battery chemistry has been progressing such that the battery that you had today is a lot better than the one from 10 years ago, not because of economies of scale solely, but also because there's new battery chemistry. Is that kind of the parallel that's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've had 100 years to optimize gasoline engines,
right?
We've had 20 years. I mean, you know, and amazingly, there are still higher performing gasoline engines coming to market, you know, which is amazing to me. There's still performance to be had there. You know, part of that is materials. Part of it is better computer technology that enables us to design better. But all just to say, we've mostly optimized out every bit of performance in a gasoline engine because we're so far down the learning curve. We're so early still in battery technology and a lot of these other things that there's still quite a bit of optimization yet to be had. And so, I think we'll see still significant performance increases in the next couple of decades. It'll probably start to, you know, slow down quite a bit.
There's two other parts of this before I want to move into some of the solution, and they're both around kind of barriers and impact. So you talked about kind of the four motivations that people might have. I think if you look at an adoption curve, and I'm just going to use home electrification as kind of the bucket for all of this, if that's okay, that'd be a fair kind of bucket to put in. So if you've got a group of people who've already moved on home electrification, they were always going to move, they're motivated for all four of those buckets or whatever happened, like for the longer tail or the bigger kind of majority that have to move now to get to, you know, 60 million households that are all electrified, like what are the barriers and the motivations that you're seeing the most of and what's changing that at the moment?
Yeah, well, I mean, here's kind of a fun couple of stats, which is, you know, cars are good for about 20 years, maybe a little bit less, maybe a little bit more, kind of depending on the home, the car owner's appetite. Homes are in a completely different category. Their lifespans are 250 years. Now every system inside of that home might have an individually lower, you know, lifespan, but on the whole, you know, if you go to the East Coast of the US, there's a lot of homes that people are living in that were built in the late 1800s, right? And so all just to say that we have a very different challenge in that you cannot build your way out of the climate crisis like you can in vehicles by just building new vehicles, right? You have to go back in and fix the old houses, right? One component at a time. And so this is a very, very like different lens that you have to sort of take on the space and going, wow, you know, unfortunately, we have to go fix all the old clunkers as opposed to just building new sexy green buildings.
Right.
And the truth is, it's just work that people don't want to do, right? It is ugly. It is hard. It is not sexy work. And so, you know, there are a lot of other things that I think people have turned their eyes towards to go work.
As in people doing the work or people who own the houses who are saying, I can't be bothered changing my windows, for example?
Well, I mean, hell, both. And I think there's a third class of just innovators of saying, well, look, if I want to go be an entrepreneur, do I want to go work on retrofitting old homes or do I want to go work on, you know, new rockets or new planes or new boats or what have you, right? It's not the shiny object. We'll just put it that way.
Do you know what I'm reminded of? I've been around software for 20 plus years and my observation especially in front end, like HTML, CSS, but in code generally, if you give an engineer a set of code that someone else wrote to solve a problem, they will invariably say, we need to rewrite it. We need to start again. And it's like, it's like such a observable trope that, you know, kind of stacks up, and maybe it's happening in houses as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of that has to do with the engineer thinking about the problem one way and the previous engineer just having thought about it a different way. And they go, well, I don't want to have to work in someone else's brain. I just want to work in my own brain. So let me just like redo the whole thing. And, you know, that's its own unique challenge, I think. But, you know, it is, I don't know. It's a coin flip, I think, generally speaking, on whether it's true or not. In software, you need to rewrite it. Sometimes, certainly, that is the case. But. Anyways.
And so let's shift gears then. Like, so you've got someone who's a household and who has had something break. Let's say that's the motivation here. And they discover you. How? Let me know how they come across you in the first place. Like, help me understand kind of what their arc of a journey looks like to go from I've got something that's broken and I want to make a better decision looking forward. What does that look like in your world?
Yeah, well, let's just talk about status quo today, right? And you know, the mental model in the US is generally one of two or three paths, which is oh shoot, I got a broken appliance. I'm going to go to that appliance. I'm going to look at it. If there's a sticker on there that says, call me at 1-800, you know, contractor. Fantastic. You're going to call that phone number because they probably have touched this piece of equipment before. They might be able to help you. So a lot of contractors will put stickers on the appliances. Second would be, oh no, I don't know or have access to a contractor. So I'm going to go to Google and go that contractor near me. Or I'm going to phone a friend and say, hey, do you have a recommendation for me? Right. That's typically how they're trying to access some, you know, a person to help them. And we have a very different door. Right. And so I'll just juxtapose the two quickly, which is great. I'm going to find a contractor. They're going to come over to my house. They're going to poke around, maybe do some diagnostics and then say, hey, this is what I would recommend you do, which could be fixing the system. It could be replacing it, so on and so forth. If we're now in the replacement category, I can't fix it. The dollar amount of this problem has probably gone up by an order of magnitude, at which point homeowners are going, oh, shoot, now I need to go get a few quotes because I don't know what it should cost. Is that really the right thing to do? And they're trying to solve for really four things, which is what's the right thing to do in this situation? What should that cost? And there's almost no pricing transparency in the ecosystem for a number of reasons, which we can get into, but I'll say they're going to want to get multiple quotes. They're going to try to figure out who they can trust to actually get the work done well. And then often they need financing because the projects are $15,000 to $20,000, you know, and so not a lot of people just have the cash sitting around to pay for that. So all to say, they go through this journey of having several folks come over, they get some prices, they need to make a decision. At the point where they're ready to make a decision, they've probably burnt 10 to 15 hours of their time into hosting contractors, gathering information, and now they're ready to make a decision. That's a lot of time and a lot of emotional energy to throw at this problem all of a sudden, all while you might have a broken appliance and an upset kid and, you know, so on and so forth. And so,
it's like, tenant.
Man, you know, I want to move fast, but I want to make a good decision, right? It's like really the motivation. And so, you know, the alternative path is to say, great, well, if you're now in a situation where you want to figure out what the right thing to do is, you can whip out your phone. You can take about 30 to 40 photos of your house, depending on the project, scan your home with your phone in about 15 minutes and authorize your utility bills to be pulled. And then you can meet with one of our advisors online and you can get pricing for up to 7 different projects. And so the difference is you can spend about 1 hour of your time total and you can get pricing on several different projects, as opposed to having one person come over who can give you one price per project. And, you know, we're reducing the amount of time a homeowner needs to spend just gathering the right information by at least an order of magnitude or more in some cases if they're trying to do multiple projects. And, you know, and then also, you know, we've spent a lot of time building some software to really provide high quality information. And so folks can get a consistently high quality, you know, experience getting the best of the best products. And that, you know, of course, really helps, drives a lot of value in those conversations. To poke, you know, the bear on contractors, but they're very busy and they don't have a lot of time to stay up with the latest and greatest. And also their business model doesn't really align with them staying up with the latest and greatest. So there's just some additional value to be had there. But we do really try to solve all four of those customer problems, which again is like what to do, what's it going to cost, who can install it properly, and then let's make sure that
they're funded. And so I want to drill into all of this because I'm trying to connect the dots. Like if someone pulls out the app and that's their starting point. Well, their starting point is I have a problem, but then they've discovered Xero and they're like, all right, let's take action. Like help me understand what that data is driving. Because like I've a real example, I've literally got a tenant who rang me on the weekend, my tenant, and she has a gas hot water heat system that's on the blink. It's not broken, but it's 30-second showers. It's not working for her. Fair enough.
Yep.
And I'm talking to a plumber who I know, and he's done work for me 3 years ago and he's a reasonable human being, but he is not looking at my bills, taking photos of the house. I mean, he walks into the house and had a look, but he walks at the machine and said, here's what I've found from looking at the machine. What's that data powering? Like, why is that data?
Yeah. So a lot of our process and a lot of what's in the app has been driven to help people purchase heat pump solutions, whether it's ducted or ductless or the like. And, you know, the design problem in heat pumps is quite challenging. if you want to take the bottoms up approach, which is the approach that we like to take, you need to know almost everything about that home. You need to know, you know, the size and shape of it. But we actually create a 3D model of the home with our software.
From the photos?
From a video walkthrough of the house. Then we take about 40 photos of the house, label all the window types, all the materials. You know, we get photos of the panel and the electrical infrastructure. And then we get photos of all the appliances and their labels, so we can pull together basically a one-to-one model of the entire home. And that then enables us to provide really high quality advice to homeowners on a broad set of projects. So it's not just heat pumps, but we can do water heaters and electrical upgrades and weatherization are really the primary items. But we also then help people with ranges and, you know, dryers if they're on gas. And
what's a ranger, sir?
A cooktop. And then, you know, in some cases we've done windows as well. So there's a pretty broad set of projects that we can help folks with, maybe batteries at some point. But the point in that is saying that if you want to do a heat pump, you need to understand how much heating and cooling the house needs. In order to do that, you really need to understand not just the structure, where that structure is. You actually have to do some simulation and whatnot to understand that properly. So we're pulling in, you know, hundreds of inputs in order to have a really accurate version of the home so that we can give people high quality advice. And the reason we've gone to such great lengths to, you know, capture that much information is that we're not just trying to solve for high quality output for the homeowner, but we've set another bar for ourselves in that we need to set the contractor up for success that's going to go out to do that project, but we can't go there, right? Our team can't go there because, you know, we're all in Colorado, but we want to help people around the country. And so in order to set that contractor for success, there's a separate, quality bar that we need to meet so that they know what they're up against before they get out to that house. And so we're trying to solve for two things, you know, the price and the scope for a homeowner so they can get comfortable and confident about what's going to happen in their house. Yeah. But we also then need to enable the contractor to then be able to show up and be successful again without having to ever go to the house.
And do you see a behavior where a contractor who's maybe come in and done a job through Xero turns around and says to clients who haven't come to Xero, please go and use Xero because I need this data to do my job properly? Is that happening, or do you think that will happen? Like, how's that looking?
Yeah, so it happens in limited amounts. And the reason for that is we don't provide our software to contractors directly today.
Sure.
We only use it in-house. And we do have a couple of contractors that do send some of their clients to us. We will then, you know, size, quote all the projects, and then we'll send it back to them directly. So that's a little bit of a unique arrangement, a little bit because of the business model itself. But, you know, that is a pretty nice way to just reflect that there is a lot of value for contractors in not having to go do the sales and marketing or the equipment ordering or any of the incentive paperwork. And we really want to help them go out in the field, be successful, driving revenue every day, as opposed to spending a bunch of their time doing things that just cost them money.
Yeah.
Right.
And not in their wheelhouse as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, a lot of these contracting businesses are started because there's a really good tradesman that thinks that they should just be in business for themselves. Yeah. But then they quickly realize they have to be good at about 7 or 8 other things in order to really run a business. And the truth is that it's really complex. And so our goal is to really enable them to spend most of their time, if not the super majority of their time, actually doing the trade and not having to spend as much time focused on all of the other things that are needed in order to be successful in the field every day.
Yeah. I mean, look, if I sort of can't get away from kind of the application of this, the idea that you provide someone with systems and brand and access to customers, even if it's not technically a franchise, is kind of the franchise playbook. And it's incredibly successful and incredibly scalable because you have a decentralized workforce who are highly motivated to solve in their own patch of earth. It's obviously geographically driven because it's homes that have to be in the one place, or overwhelmingly are in the one place. Have you thought, I mean, I know we're off on a tangent, but have you thought about taking the model out and making it so someone can run their own business but more connected to it in that way, like as a, not as a franchise necessarily, but in a model where they can utilize the technology to run their entire business and to actually bring all their customers through it? Like, how are you thinking about that?
Yeah, I mean, today we really want to be the front door for homeowners and saying that no matter where you're at, you can always talk to Zero. We can help you understand what the scope of work is, what to do in your house. We can get you a good price, and then we'll get you connected to a vetted contractor, right? Now, we're only active in 4 states in the U.S., and, you know, we have ambitions to be in a dozen or so within the next year. But you're right in saying that, you know, Zero is probably not going to be the front door for everyone. And the problem we're trying to solve is very big, right? 60 million homes. Is Zero going to help 60 million individuals go through, you know,
this process? It's a lot of call center staff. What did you call them? Concierge? Specialists? What do we call the word?
We call them advisors. To homeowners, And so, you know, it's unlikely that we're going to, you know, operationally help every single homeowner. So, yes, there's certainly some lofty goals to enable contractors to use these types of tools. But it's a little bit off on the horizon for us. We're really focused today around the marketplace model that we're building, really being the front door for homeowners. And a big component of that is, you know, the surface area of the product that we're building is actually quite large. It spans everything from the homeowner entry point to an entire sales process and design process, you know, selecting the right equipment, and then ultimately also installing this. There's field applications as well that we're working on. And so it's just a very large software suite, as opposed to what you often see as being a very niche tool that is sold to contractors kind of one-off. We're really trying to build an entire ecosystem and you know, actually do it ourselves, right? To really prove that, you know, what we're doing works. And and then ultimately really reduce costs as well. So that's a big component for us. It's very expensive.
I think as well, you have to, like, this, like, my main business, that is a total unrelated business, but has a lot of parallels with this, where you are also trying to introduce new ways of doing things. And the common, you know, method for, you know, innovating is to go and talk to your customers about the way they want to do it. And you get the Steve Jobs of the world saying, you can't make step changes by doing this. You actually have to come up with a new way of doing things, prove that that way is better, and then bring people on the journey to come into that new way of doing things. And it's hard to do that when you are taking direction from the people who are already working a certain way and are resistant to change, or, you know, can't see the vision that you have.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, having been a contractor, right, I'd like very deeply understand the emotional and physical pain with running such a complex business that has very low operating margins and almost zero operating leverage. So it's they're very difficult to grow, and they're very complex. They don't get less complex over time. So this is just a hard business, right? And, you know, I think there's just an opportunity for us to help those folks reduce the complexity of their business over time. And then ultimately help the homeowner, but it's really focused on being an enabling layer there for both parties. And you know, I think that's just the really critical lens to kind of put on this. And in order to do that, you actually have to transform the problem from being in the physical domain and literally put it into the digital domain, right? And that affords you to have all these new opportunities on how to solve that problem, but the truth is just that the entire ecosystem is stuck in solving the education problem for homeowners and the scoping problem for contractors in the physical. And so they have to go to the house, and that causes a huge number of costs and problems. And, you know, it's a bad customer experience. And so that's the clear innovation barrier that we've had to overcome is being able to solve this problem in the digital. And from there, then you have lots of opportunities to then innovate. And so your point, sorry, I'm taking the long way to to your point, which is that in order to get a totally new process stood up, you have to innovate all the way there. And people's mental models of how to solve this problem are to go look at the sticker on the appliance, go to Google, or ask a friend. It is not to, hey, pull out your phone and download an app, right? And that is sort of a marketing burden that we're going to have to bear over time. But you know, to date, we've been very focused on how do you build the technology? How do you build a process that can deliver consistently high quality experience? And I think we've done that. So now it's really time to start to push, you know, into some other areas to innovate. And, you know, fortunately, I think the market is telling us that they really like this solution. Right? Like our NPS scores are great. We're getting lots of referrals. You know, it's a good product. So maybe too early to date to say like we have really, really good customer fit, but we're growing like a weed. So it's
great.
solid glimmers, I would say, thus far of like
good green weedy shoots. I love it. I've got a couple of thoughts and ideas, but you know, not to you've obviously gone down a bunch of rabbit holes. But this thing about the sticker on the side is a really interesting thing for me. Like right now, sitting in my mailbox, I actually checked this morning. There is actually a magnet from a plumber who obviously lives in the area who wants me to stick that magnet on my fridge. I've got about 8 magnets on my fridge, none of them from plumbers at this point. But at some point, he's going to win. You know, I'll put that thing there. But I'm reminded of what AOL did back in the mid-90s, I think it was, when they just started mailing CDs to houses. And that's how they got such big footprint, was they just said, you need to get online. Someone else has told you, here's the CD. That's all you need to do is stick it in the CD tray. And everyone had CD trays at that point. So that was the right mechanism, the right channel. And I just imagine a world where Zero's out sending stickers to households saying, if you could do one thing to help yourself 5 years from now, stick this sticker on one of these 3 appliances that you already have in your home and call us when there's a problem. And here's the reason you would. That's all you have to do right now. Buy a stickers business would be...
Yeah, I mean, you're really highlighting, I think, one of the core challenges in this space, which is distribution, right? And being well known enough. And one of the challenges in this space is it's extremely fragmented. I mean, 80%+ of the contracting businesses in the U.S. are 4 people or less, right? Which means that, you know, it's highly, highly fragmented. And because of that, then every marketing channel is incredibly saturated. Everyone's fighting each other for, space in one or many channels. And that drives up costs pretty substantially. And so one of the challenges, I think, in general is actually to reduce costs, you actually just need to reduce the cost of marketing ultimately.
Right.
And I think we have a couple of unique features about our business that might enable us to really drive down the cost of marketing and do so for a very long time. You earlier asked, and I'll answer the question now, which is how do homeowners even find out about you? We don't do any marketing, actually. We really, really never have. We have a partnership strategy. We help utilities, cities, and then other businesses that have a vested interest in helping homeowners do these projects. And we provide our technology platform to them to help them operate more efficiently and effectively. And that is really how we've gotten out to market is through affiliates.
Interesting. I was gonna definitely ask exactly how you're going about it. And I think that'll probably evolve as well. You'll find a channel that works and you'll go and exploit it and it'll work to a point. And then there'll be a whole set of customers for whom the thing in the mail or the thing on the utility bill doesn't work and they need the sticker in the mail or whatever the other cool hack is that's going to come out. The thing that I'm finding, and you haven't actually touched on it, but I'm going to make a leap, that one of the things that's really interesting about how you think about a customer is, and you kind of touched on it, there's a set of things that they're going to need to do over a period of time. And the initial, hey, I've got a heat pump opportunity because my current heater broke or whatever it is, the amount of data and the depth of the relationship that you create in that first one means that you're now first in line for everything that comes after that. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's right. And the customer journey they get on the second project is unbelievable.
Unbelievable, yeah.
They don't have to go through any of the data collection process anymore. They can call up Zero and say, hey, I'd like to get a price on XYZ thing. And in 10 minutes, we go, great, here it is.
Amazing.
As compared to, shoot, I got to find a bunch more contractors. I don't know them. I don't trust them, right? And so the idea there is to say, great, well, we've picked the hardest project to do such that people are willing to do a little bit of work to capture that information. And then every project going forward is incredibly easy to get very transparent, competitive pricing from someone who's going to deliver a really good experience.
And the loop is closed, right? Because the loop's closed because you've already, let's say you put in a heat pump in project number one, you put a heat pump in, you know what went in. So your map of the house is now updated with used to have electric heater, now have heat pump, whatever.
That's right. And you know what? Even if something's changed since then, like maybe we take 2 or 3 more photos and we capture a few more pieces of information, but the model we maintain internally is exactly as you said. So if we need to make a new change to it, fantastic. We're happy to do that. But all just then to say that you get an outrageous customer journey, which is extremely, extremely affordable, as opposed to, again, having to have a bunch of people come over. And so, we really seek to have a relationship with homeowners for the long haul and saying, once you've done a little bit of work, we're going to deliver incredible levels of value, you know, for the entire time you own that home. Mm. And, you know, the goal then is to have, you know, I don't know if this is the right phrasing, but like basically a digital sticker, right? And saying,
yeah, I was going to say,
instead of running to any other appliance, you already know that Xero can help you with these things. You can whip out your phone, hit the Mayday button and go, great. Hey, like, help me understand.
Is there literally a Mayday button?
That's a future thing that I want to put in the app. It's just like, oh man, the ship's going down. Please help.
I love it. You should totally do that.
Totally. And you know, I mean, look, life's too short. You got to be a little silly, right? All just to say, you know, we really want to have that relationship. Of course, it's good for the business, but it can deliver unparalleled value for the homeowner. So that there's just a nice, tight opportunity there for us.
I mean, that's when great businesses are built, when something is compelling for all the stakeholders, the people who run, in this case, a marketplace yourselves, the people who are building on it in terms of contractors and installing, and are like, this is so much better. I much prefer when my customers come from this than just ring me up and say, you're one of three people I'm talking to, and you need to come over and bill on this thing, and you have a one in three chance of getting it, and all I'm driven by is price, and you're not even thinking about the broader aspect. And then obviously for the homeowner, it's interesting with the thing on the app is an interesting one, because I think if you look at society 10 years ago when apps, you know, maybe 15 years ago when apps were kind of in their heyday, everyone was happy to put an app on their phone for, excuse my language, pretty much anything. I was going to swear, but I'm not going to.
Yeah.
And that was the norm. I mean, if you think about Apple's marketing strategy, it was an app for that. That was a normalized behavior. And the pendulum swung the other way, where if now you say to someone, hey, to access this service, you're going to need an app, people are like, there better be a really compelling reason why this thing needs to be an app. It can't just be a web-based app. But if you do have a really compelling reason to be there, it's amazing real estate. I'm an early small investor in a company here in Australia called Amber Electric. That is an electricity retailer who provides the wholesale price to the customer. And So you get the price changes every 30 minutes, which is a problem, but it means you get really cheap electricity for about 8 hours a day, and you've got people charging their electric cars and getting paid to do it. So it's an unbelievably compelling value prop, but you need to look at the energy price and get notifications on a regular basis. It just wouldn't work if it wasn't an app. But the net outcome of that is people who are customers have this thing on their phone and they can easily show someone, look how I solved this problem. And so their word of mouth is unbelievably sticky as a result. So you're in this wonderful position as well, I'd say, to emulate that type of outcome.
Yeah. And, you know, we've really focused to date, we're still an early business, on enabling homeowners to digitize their home. That is really the only use for the app. It's a one-time, great, we're going to help you through this project. But we have lofty ambitions to make that an entire ecosystem of, great, you're going to operate your home through the app, you know, so on and so forth. There's going to be an entire world in there that's going to enable folks to have a good relationship with their home, and then ultimately be able to get access to someone that can help them with, you know, basically any project they'd like to fulfill.
Mm, interesting. Okay, there's a whole rabbit hole thing we'll go down there. I've got a couple other questions relating to your current, you know, focus. when I had a look through it, a lot of what I saw an emphasis on in terms of the, you know, you talked about six or seven things that you might need to do in the home. A lot of the focus was on things relating to heating and cooling, heat pumps and the like, and some relating to kind of induction, but much less talking about things that might generate electricity like solar and storage. Can you help me understand the priority? I'm sure you're across all of them, but it seemed like there was a focus in that area, and help me understand that.
Yeah, we actually don't do solar. And we today don't do batteries, and eventually we may get into batteries. But the focus really has been just to say that, look, there are lots of companies that do solar today, and they leverage tools like Aurora Solar, EagleView, and the like to provide a sales process that I would say is broadly delightful. It's not perfect. There's certainly some challenges there, but it's a lot better still than having someone come to your house. And we just don't have any way to innovate on that with our current process, because we're mapping the inside of a house, right? And so we don't have a good way to say, great, well, we can help you understand where the solar panels ought to go on your house and the scope of work there. We're really trying to be complementary to those folks and say, great, this is a huge gap in the market. There's no information on what's inside of a home or how, you know, to actually do one of these projects. So let's build something alongside of that, as opposed to trying to directly compete with that. And you know, that's great, frankly. And that way we can be, you know, pretty complementary to a lot of, you know, what folks are doing in solar today, which is, you know, it has been a very large industry in the U.S. Of course, with a lot of the recent changes, I think it's on the pretty rapid decline, but, you know, that sort of is what it is. But we're not trying to, you know, reinvent a wheel that already exists, I guess, maybe the short
term. Yeah. I mean, from your perspective, you see a much bigger gap and opportunity in these types of products that aren't been doing anywhere near as well and are nowhere near as saturated. And in some respects, are a lot less along the curve of adoption. I mean, solar in Australia is like 2/3 of households or something ridiculous in terms of houses that could have it.
Yeah.
I think highest penetration.
The U.S. penetration is more. I mean, I think it's 5%, something like that.
Oh, really? Okay.
And, you know, that there's a lot of structural challenges for that. But, you know, one of the other things that is important to keep in mind is there's been just this huge, what folks lovingly call this the solar coaster in the U.S., driven off interest rates, driven off a number of different things. There's a huge boom bust cycle in solar, and there's been several of them. That's not great for business in general, right? So if you want to go build a durable, enduring business, it's best to focus on industries that don't have quite such a boom bust cycle, unless you can innovate in a way that you could really believe that might reduce that. All just to say that, you know, heating and cooling, water heating, they're very durable industries because in a lot of ways they're, you know, life support systems, right?
Right.
Maybe right. Less water heating, but people do not like taking cold showers, right? you know, heating your home. Yeah, exactly. heating your house in the middle of winter is, you know, could be a matter of life and death. And so the point being that people will spend on these appliances. It's sort of a requirement as opposed to a nice to have. Even air conditioning in a lot of ecosystems is a nice to have as opposed to a requirement. So that's another focus for that for us. Of course, also the climate aspect of that. There's a number of dimensions that we sort of look at that. But the gnarliest problem for sure in design is in the heating and cooling space. And we thought there's a great opportunity there and a huge gap in technology and experience to target
that. Yeah, understood. And then you talked about kind of the four steps of this, and one of them was the last one, I guess, well, not the last one, but a big enabler was finance. How does that play into, is it you or is it you partnering? Is it an affiliate again? Like, how does the finance play into it all?
Yeah, it's all partnering today. We don't make any money off the financing. We've not done any innovation there. You know, maybe at some point we will provide financing directly, but there's a lot of complexity to that. And look, there's hundreds of people, of organizations in the country that'll help you help a homeowner finance something. So again, we're not likely going to be any better at it than them. So let's just partner with them as opposed to trying to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah. It's, again, I like think about kind of some of the examples that I've had exposure to here and even in the US as well. And at some point in their growth trajectory, the financiers start knocking because they're like, we've got customers. You know, there's a big bank here has 6 million customers, which is a lot for Australia because we've only got 27 million people. And they're taking stakes in telcos and energy retailers and the like, specifically so they can say, if you go and get their energy using us as a banking customer, your economics will be different. We'll give you a different interest rate. We won't charge you these fees, whatever it is. And they're trying to create an ecosystem around their financial services customers. So I think there's an inevitable outcome for you, which is you're going to get close to finance.
Well, yeah. And you know, something I've learned in the past maybe 6 to 9 months is a lot about insurance. And you know, the costs of that are going up precipitously in the US. And the sort of remarkable thing is that insurers know almost nothing about the homes they're insuring. Actually, they just underwrite it at a total portfolio basis and have really no idea what the individual home looks like. And so there's a really interesting opportunity there potentially to, you know, help create a new insurance product and saying, great, if you'd like this product, go ahead, scan your house. If we can collect just a small handful of data points, they can have much better underwriting models to support maybe much more affordable home insurance. And I'll just give one example of that, which is one of the largest losses insurers have in homes is when the water heater cracks and floods the house. If they could just understand one data point, which is the age of a home, the age of the water heater, they might go so far as to just pay for the replacement outright. and that's
save themselves the hassle of a $40,000 flooding incident.
That's right. And, you know, of course, again, another way to maybe finance these projects is just to say, great, we could actually just wrap that right into your home insurance because it makes a lot of sense. We can give you a much better rate to replace some of these things. So there's sort of an interesting conversation there to be had at some point. We're not really tackling that at the moment, but, you know, just there's a lot of opportunity, you know, again, when you transform all this information into a digital asset that you can leverage, right, deliver value for owners.
I mean, we actually had the InsurTech Gateway guys on the show a couple of years ago, and their whole shtick is if you have different data from the rest of the, you know, the masses, then there's probably an insurance wrapper that sits around that data that will change the outcome for someone who has a problem to solve that's a higher order problem than I just don't want my house to be broken. So in their case, they were talking about flooding as an example. If you have data about where floods go up to, you can insure where the flood goes up to. And as long as it doesn't go past this, you can just insure past that. Where if you like, it only goes to, you know, knee height, it's not going to damage the home. You'll only insure if it goes over knee height because you've got the data to know that really only happens 1 in 100 years. And like, just fascinating change to the insurance model. It's about half the cost of the insurance, but it insures you for the one that you're actually worried about, not the, you know, heavy rain that happened for 2 days that soaked your garden but didn't muck your house up.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, it's a remarkable world when you have data that is not available to everyone. Yeah. It's just never been available, frankly. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, homes are just completely in that category. You know, there's just almost no information on homes. You can go to Zillow as an example. I mean, best you can basically get is the square footage of a home, maybe the year built. Often not even that many, how many bedrooms or bathrooms it has, because people are just remodels and whatnot. So yeah, it's just it's a wild ecosystem for sure.
And I've got just a couple of questions. We always get to time faster than I imagine with this thing, but that's always a good sign. So you talked before about some of the motivations, and these two questions are kind of related. One of them is something breaks, clearly it has to be replaced, but one was relating to comfort. Something just isn't solving it for you. Like, I'm curious about like how much of this is motivated by, I'm sick of that heater, it doesn't work properly, or, you know, we're not warm enough in winter. I've got a heater that's kind of doing this at the moment, by the way, just as an aside. Like, how much of that is motivation, or do people tend to just wait till it breaks and they're like, you know, delay and delay and delay? And then my related question is, when things come out of the home broken or almost broken, what's happening to all these things? Like, and how do you think about that closed loop of environmental impact, I guess?
Yeah. Well, the last one's an easy answer, which is we recycle it. We have our trade partners go and recycle all that stuff. But, you know, the first piece is really related to, you know, my appliance is likely to be broken. You know, it's pretty rare for people to jump off the couch and say, hey, I want to go spend $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 on solving one of these problems unless they have quite a high level of pain. And often it is not high enough on comfort alone, unless it's really bad, you know, in the house, for them to go, okay, it's time to start doing something. And so often it's when, you know, things are starting to get close to, I need to replace this thing. They're talking about, well, look, my house isn't actually that comfortable. So let's also try to solve that in the midst of replacing the appliance. And I'll give you a good example of this. There is a woman we helped. She lives in a very, very cold part of Colorado, gets down to negative 20 F there. And
I don't know what that is in Celsius, but I think it's about minus 20 as well. It's close to the crossover point of minus
20. Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, that's about right. you know, she had a direct vented furnace. It wasn't working very well. The top floor of her home was so cold that she couldn't even go up there in the middle of winter. And, you know, she was quite motivated to replace that. But of course, she didn't have the money. I mean, her annual income or her monthly income was like sub $2,000. And so sort of remarkable thing is both in a rural part of the country, there's very little access to help. There are very few contractors to help. So, you know, we were able to help her get the information she needed on how to actually get a better system for her home. And because of one of the financing partners, that we have and some of the local utility incentives, she got a new system that is going to heat her entire home year round. She paid nothing out of pocket for it and actually saves her money every month. She got infinite ROI and a system that, you know, is actually going to heat her. Right. And, you know, that those are the types of things that are really like, you know, get you up in the morning to go, okay, hey, like we have an opportunity to go actually really help people along the path to solving this massive, like very ambitious global climate crisis problem.
Yeah. Right?
And, you know, there's like real joy to deliver there, which is very cool. And often that is what you're seeing day to day because, you know, emissions are so ethereal and whatnot, both to consumers and to us as a business that, you know, what you often find is you're actually just solving real world problems for homeowners. And, you know, if you do that enough times, you actually can go impact the the climate problem along the way.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, yeah, it's as much a human problem as it is a climate problem. And it's we're at a point in history where those two things, as you said right up front, are aligned and can produce both outcomes in the same breath. Probably the closing question then, like just in terms of the road that's in front of you right now, like what's front of mind? What's the thing that you're focused on, you know, seeing or the next big milestone for you guys that you're really excited about?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've really proven that what we built works. You know, we've delivered hundreds and hundreds of projects at this point, and we're really trying to, you know, scale the solution. So we're in the midst of finishing a fundraise to have the capital to really try to blow the doors off of this thing. And I think we got a really good opportunity to make this maybe, you know, if we're very successful, the primary way that people go to, you know, get projects done in their homes and save people the time, the money, and the heartache of figuring out what to do. And, you know, if we can be the front door for homeowners, I think we have a huge opportunity to really change the way that, you know, this is done in the U.S. And you know, if we are very successful, then maybe we can, you know, go beyond the borders of the U.S. as well.
Amazing. Can't wait to see it. Just as a side note, we tend to interview people just as they hit an inflection point. It's happened at least, you know, probably 1 in 3 times of the people we talk to. And I kind of get that vibe talking to you today. So really looking forward to seeing how it all progresses for you. And excited that you joined the show and really excited for what you guys are doing. So thank you again, Greg.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're having more fun than we ever have. And hopefully there's a lot more to be had.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Shape the System. As usual, if you'd like to suggest a guest, someone that you know who's helped change a system for the better, please go to www.shapethesystem.org, click on the top right-hand corner, then click Suggest Guest. Make sure that you click Subscribe so that you get the new episode. Shape the System is an independent podcast with support from KPMG High Growth Ventures. Connects founders to the services they need along their journey. Whether you are looking to refine your strategy, mature your finance function, prepare for a capital raise, expand abroad, or simply comply with regulatory requirements, they provide you with the support you need to drive your business forward.